Philip Morgan.
Liston.io. I'm going to start referring to you by your domain name from here on out.
You know, I was thinking of getting that tattooed on my arm and legally changing my name. What do you think about that plan?
I think you should check with your wife first about that. And I think she's going to say the same thing I would say, which is you're going to regret that real quick.
Philip, that is the advice of a true friend. Thank you.
You're going to regret that with a quickness.
Yes, sir.
How are you doing today, buddy? Aside from fantasizing about Liston.io tattoos.
I'm good. Now, I did want to give a shout out to Anthony. Now, I don't know if Anthony listens to our podcast, but I got an email. So I know we often have a little bit of banter about hip hop or sort of whatever kind of fun or interesting or different things, or sometimes Liston's gripes come in the beginning of the podcast. But I got an email because in my newsletter, I recommended the new Black Thought album.
Yeah.
Which was on Spotify, which is awesome. Have you listened to it yet?
I have. I need to give it a subsequent listen. I have an update for you, by the way, about Kendrick Lamar and me, but go ahead. I listened to it once.
So, amazing album. In my opinion, by far the most underrated rapper ever.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He's just so amazing.
Yeah.
And so I recommend this in my newsletter.
Yeah.
And Anthony responds, I'll hold his last name back, because I didn't ask him if I could talk about this. And he responded and said, oh, this is so cool. I didn't know you were a fan of Black Thought. Like, I never would have guessed.
Huh.
And I went off and I wrote a post about assumptions that we make in our sales process.
Right.
Right. So there's something basically a well-known psychological phenomenon, like how everybody talks about the importance of first impressions. Well, it turns out to be true because with a very small amount of information, we sort of fill in all the details of a human being in our brains, right?
Yeah.
Even if you were asked, okay, so tell me what kind of music does this person listen to? Like, you wouldn't necessarily have an answer, but you would know what would surprise you. So I wrote this post about like how we shouldn't make assumptions. And for instance, someone was really surprised that I'm a hip hop fan. And by the way, I record hip hop and I produce hip hop. And so I sent the post to him and I said, Anthony, thank you so much. Like, you really inspired me. And it seemed like he kind of took it as like, oh crap, like I didn't mean it for you to take it that way. Sort of like I was lashing out at him.
Right.
I was trying to say like, no, like you genuinely inspired me. And like, it's something we all do. And it was just sort of like a teaching moment, not for you, but for everybody.
Right.
So I wanted to let you, Philip, and everybody listening to this know that if you interact with me, there's a chance you're going to be my muse for a second, and you may end up in my writing, but please don't take it as a personal slight.
I recently also, this was some content I was putting together for specialization school, had a chance to look smart for a second and reference what's called schema theory. This is from Psychology and Cognitive Science. I'll read the first two sentences of the Wikipedia article. In psychology and cognitive science, a schema, plural, schemata or schemas, describe a pattern of thought or behavior that organizes categories of information and the relationships among them. It can also be described as a mental structure of preconceived ideas, a framework representing some aspect of the world, or a system organizing and perceiving new information. So, as you know, mentally, we are like super stingy with our cognitive resources. And a schema is sort of like a pattern that represents all the underlying instances of that pattern. So probably a clean-cut white dude represents.
Right. Yeah. I'm an archetype. And
exactly.
Listening to Black Thought was not part of the archetype he had assigned me. I totally understand. Yeah. I agree.
We all do it because our minds are very stingy with cognitive resources. We can't treat each human being. We should, but we can't treat them as, well, I don't know. We can't treat each new human as a unique snowflake that they are.
And that is exactly the point I was trying to get across, is like, it's not about you. It's about how the human brain works, because the world is so complicated that the brain needs to create shortcuts to manage all the stimuli, right? It's just like the way the system works, because it's the only way that it can possibly function effectively.
Yeah.
However, it's a disservice when we're trying to create relationships. And so all I was trying to say is, hey, we all make assumptions. Let's be aware of it and try to correct whenever it's happening. And especially in a client or selling situation, go into it with an open mind and check your assumptions.
We make the assumptions, and then, like, I don't know, maybe if you imagine walking into the, you're trying to sell your services to an agency, you walk into their office and it's like really fancy looking. And you're like, oh, they must be doing really well to have such a nice office. That would be potentially a terrible assumption that could cost you an opportunity, because you then skip over asking these questions like, so tell me about your pipeline, or what's your close rate, or I'm casting this example in terms that are specific to you. But yep, you might miss opportunities by making those wrong assumptions. And then you combine with that the fact that we don't like to, sometimes we don't like to ask questions because we think that undermines our expertise. But if you went to a doctor and they didn't ask enough questions, you could get a wrong diagnosis. And that could be harmful or deadly. Same with the work we do. You got to be the dumbest guy in the room, as Jonathan Stark says, in that discovery, in that early part of the conversation.
Well, and also people do die on a regular basis from misdiagnosis.
Yeah.
Right? Not to say it's all the result of faulty assumptions, but certainly some percentage of it is. And so that's all I wanted to convey. So Anthony, if you're listening, I love you. I didn't take it personally. I wanted to pass along that I thought it was so exciting that you inspired an article, and hopefully this clears up the air. So thank you for writing to me.
Anthony's our mascot for today's show.
Speaking of today's show, Philip, well, wait. Before we get into it, tell me what you want to promote.
Oh, I want to promote Specialization School. I think by the time this publishes, it's going to be too late to sign up for the July cohort. And that's okay, because you can see the results of me paying this developer on Codeable $200 to make the plugin that I use to display the schedule work better by going to specializationschool.com, scrolling down about, I don't know, half of the page. And then there's a schedule of upcoming workshops.
Is that done?
It is now.
It is now at the time of publishing, or now as in like now?
Now. Yeah, if you go to specializationschool.com. It's this pretty nifty plugin called something, I think it's called Google Inline Sheet Viewer. It's a WordPress plugin. It pulls the contents of a Google sheet and displays them as a really pretty nicely formatted table on a WordPress site.
Yes.
And it wasn't, you know, didn't have grid lines between the cells and a couple other little annoyances. So I hired a developer to make it do what I wanted. He was great. Codeable is great, by the way, for little quick, easy WordPress development projects, or maybe other development projects too.
It is at the time of this publishing, and dear listener, when you're listening to this, it is too late for you to sign up for the July cohort. Yeah. However, there is time to sign up for the October cohort.
There's a lot of time. Yeah. I'm taking most of August off, taking maybe 2 weeks off, and then already have set up on my calendar where folks can't set up calls and stuff like that. And I'll kind of ramp down for the month of August. So September would be when you might start registering for that. But if you wanted to lock in a seat now, I'm always open to that. So I just want to direct folks to the schedule for Specialization School. Again, it's specializationschool.com, and you can see a schedule of upcoming workshops. And if you're thinking about any of those, be a good time to start planning for them. How about you, listening? You got anything you want to promote?
I do. So I want to promote my new podcast, creatively called The Liston.io Show.
How did you come up with that name?
I storyboarded a few things. I had sort of a mood board where I just kind of sat back for inspiration, and I thought,
you hired a branding company, right?
This needs more of me. That's all I thought the whole time.
How can I put more of me in this?
In all seriousness, the reason I chose the name is just because my name is unique. I can be monominous. What a great word, Philip, monominous.
What a great word.
Someone with a single name. So Liston.io obviously being my website, and it's really just personal branding. That's the only reason I did it. But it is a place for consultants to learn how to build a better consulting business. And so I'm really excited about it. I'm doing half interviews, half solo shows. All you have to do is go to liston.io/podcast. In order to see it, subscribe, listen, whatever you want to do.
Sweet. Can I tell you that I have a slightly warmer relationship with Kendrick Lamar now?
I would like to know about this.
I think part of the problem sometimes is I listen to music wrong. Like I do it the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
Remember Antenna Gate with the iPhone, whatever, 4 or whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
And then Steve Jobs emailed some pissed off user and said, avoid holding it that way, but it got translated in the press to you're holding it wrong. I think I just sometimes listen to music wrong.
Which is essentially what he was saying.
Yeah.
There's a correct way to hold the phone and you're not doing it.
I think there's a correct way to listen to some music and I'm not doing it. Like, obviously EDM is better at a rave or at a festival than it might be at home. And I found with Kanye that listening in the car just made it better. Like the whole thing, just the experience was different.
Kanye or Kendrick Lamar?
Kanye, but I watched the Kendrick Lamar music video for Humble.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Which is an amazing video.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like top 10 in terms of just the coolness of the video itself. And that made the music cooler to consume it that way or experience it that way.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying his music's not good. I acknowledge his talent, but I liked it more is the thing I'm saying. It just sort of worked better when it was done that way. And so I just wanted to mention that I'm warming a little bit because of that to Kendrick Lamar. I'm going to check out some more of his music videos soon.
And for all of the nerds out there, the scene where he's standing in the LA River, which is just like kind of a dirt. He and some friends are like standing in the dirt and there's these big concrete pillars and concrete behind them. There's this amazing robotic arm. I don't know if you remember, but it like zooms in really fast and shoots around and pans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's not CGI. It's a camera mounted onto a robot arm, which is amazing.
I was wondering how they did that. That effect, I mean, it'll be overused in 2 or 3 years, but it was so fresh. Like, I'd never seen anything like that.
Well, I mean, I was watching it and I was like, how in the world did they do that? You're not a sports guy, but Intel sponsors the NBA. They have the capability of on any play, they can freeze frame the play and then pan the camera around the person 180 degrees and then continue it. And it creates almost that kind of effect. Except that clearly it wasn't done that way because there's no blip or movement. People are still standing and acting in the same way in the same place. So
yeah,
that was pretty cool. So I like that also.
That's neat. So let me set up our topic today.
Please.
Shall I?
Yeah.
I looked at our Asana board and saw there were no topics under ideas and thought, oh no, the podcast is over. It's not. Listen, I remember the first time I was in something like a sales call or a meeting with a client that was sort of a sales thing years and years ago. And I was nervous, had no idea what I was doing, and lacking confidence would be the best word to describe how I was. And well, actually you could throw in a couple other adjectives too, like sort of ignorant, like fumbling my way through it. So I thought we could talk about the topic of how are you confident in that setting of a sales conversation, or how do you become confident if you're not? I think you'll have a lot to say about that. I've seen, thankfully, some growth in my own self in that area as well. So I can share a little bit about that too. But what makes people not confident when they're heading into a sales call? Let's say they are very competent. They're even good or great at what they do, but maybe in the sales call, they're not very confident. What causes that?
Well, I think it depends on the person.
Yeah.
One thing that could definitely be going on is they're placing a lot of pressure on themselves to sell something. And so that affects the confidence because then there's this question of like, okay, well, will they go for it?
Mm-hmm.
If the goal is to walk away with $10,000 from the call, you know already that there's no way that you can guarantee that outcome. You can influence it, right?
Right.
But you're immediately going to be less confident because you know you may not achieve the outcome that you're after. So I think that that's one thing. It's also scary to talk about money because we're taught we shouldn't from a very young age. And I don't know if that's universal, but I think most Western cultures, you typically don't talk about money. It's not something that's polite. You know, I think there are other reasons too. I think maybe it's just lack of practice. So I think it would be helpful to talk about where confidence comes from. So a while ago, Philip, I think you asked about confidence. You said, wouldn't it just be great to be that cool kid in high school who has it all under control and they're so confident.
I remember exactly what you said to me.
What did I say?
You said, I was that cool kid. You listed off some of the your cool kid credentials.
Yes.
And then you said, inside, I was like the opposite of what you would think or something like that. I think you can give me the exact quote, but I remember that vividly because I don't have a ton of friends who were the cool kid in high school.
Yeah, no, what I said was inside I was incredibly insecure. So your notion of what the cool kid felt, not that I'm representative of every cool kid in the world, but it didn't apply to me, certainly.
Yeah.
And so I went off and you said, that would be a great article. You should write it. So I did. So on my website, you can read what I have to say about being the cool kid in high school, but it made me start to dig into what is this confidence thing about? Where does it come from? Why do we experience it? Why don't we? Yeah. The best article that I've found, and certainly I wouldn't say there's a canon of research and literature about this, but there is some research in the field of psychology about where confidence comes from. And the way that it was summarized that sort of resonated the best with me was three dimensions of confidence. One is belief in your competence, meaning you're capable of doing something. Belief in your ability to learn and problem solve. How can you adapt and apply? Number three, belief in your own intrinsic self-worth. Okay.
Interesting.
There's a lot there.
All those start with the idea of some kind of belief, which is interesting. We'll probably end up talking about that more. Anyway.
We will, because I got... It's funny you latched onto that because someone wrote me back when I shared this with my email list. And I said, oh, great point. Let's talk about belief and false beliefs. And
if I may.
Yeah, please.
Because people can believe a lot of shit.
Yes.
There are apparently people who believe the earth is flat.
Well.
And.
Maybe they just like attention.
Right. I'm not inside their mind, so I don't know. It certainly is a way to get attention now. But let's just sort of. Say that there are some people who honestly believe that. And that's just been so thoroughly, like it can be disproved 100 different ways. So you can believe a lot of things. And that's what to me was so interesting about that is because belief is malleable. Maybe some of these other things are not so malleable, but beliefs are. And that seems to suggest that maybe we can grow in confidence by changing our beliefs.
I think it does, but I'd actually move to a more concrete level, right? So I believe climate change is real. Why do I believe that? Well, there's a mountain of evidence that I can point to, right? So I can substantiate that belief, even though we don't know to 100% certainty. I mean, it's, let's be honest, it's greater than 99%, right? It's very close to 100%, but take it at the individual level. So do I have confidence in my ability to jump on a sales call? Well, can I say with 100% certainty that I'm perfect at sales? No, I could say the opposite, though. With 100% certainty, I'm not perfect at sales. How good am I? Well, that's a harder question to answer, but that's kind of where I would start. So number one is competence.
So competence at the skill or the thing you're selling, like let's say I'm selling my own services. Mm-hmm. Is the belief about my competence at delivering the services, or is it my belief about my competence in that sales call situation?
I think it's both. That's a really good question, but I think it's both. So for instance, I'm pretty athletic,
yeah,
but I would not be confident I'd be any good at football because I've never played, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I'm confident that if I play in a pickup basketball game, I'm going to be one of the best people there. Because I played a lot and I have a lot of evidence to support that. So even though they're both athletics, they're related, right? I'm still using my body to do a thing that moves a ball in a direction.
Right?
Right? It's not exactly the same. And so all I want to do is make the point that we have different levels of confidence in different spheres of our lives, and they don't necessarily cross over.
Totally.
So in your example, you're great at a thing. You're a consultant. You're an expert in what you do. Maybe you fully believe that wholeheartedly, right?
Uh-huh.
One question you may have is, how do I know I can help the next person? Where does that come from? Well, that's number two, belief in your ability to learn and problem solve. Can I continually adapt and apply this expertise that I have to new situations, and will it be successful? So I do think there's something to be said for experience. But I think another thing to do is that competence piece. I think that is very, very easy to change. So I have Consulting Sales Bootcamp, whereby I teach people how to be better at selling their consulting services.
Mm-hmm.
My belief is I can dramatically improve their competence and through simulation, help them start to adapt and apply that competence, the knowledge that they've acquired, which should increase their belief. Now, yeah. It's hard for me to really affect anyone else's intrinsic self-worth. We need to figure that out on our own. And I always like to say that I'm an extremely late bloomer in my career because I focus so much on my personal development and like kind of figuring out what in the hell does all of this mean and why am I here and why does this matter? And so it took me a while to get to the competence in the problem solving part. But I do believe that there are ways to adjust those things by applied effort. We've heard the term readers are leaders, or is it leaders or readers? I forget which one it is, but
I haven't heard that term at all, either variation of it.
Oh, really?
No, that's cool.
But it is true. I mean, I think it's true mostly. Like, I don't meet very exceptionally smart, successful people. And I don't mean successful in terms of money. I just mean successful in terms of like amazing human beings. I don't meet many of them who aren't extremely curious and consuming more information to better understand the world, right?
That makes me think it must be leaders are readers.
I think you're right.
That's got to be it. Anyway, that's how I would say it if I had made that up.
Yeah, we can get into a logic problem, but you must be right because...
Because I always am.
Exactly.
Moving right along.
Exactly. Well, who has the confidence now, Morgan?
Boom. I can talk a good game. Okay. Yeah. So one of the things I see is, and I see this in my work and with the people I'm working with, I'm always trying to help them get experience in a lower stakes situation. That's often a part of these workshop experiences I'm setting up is, how can you practice thing X in a situation where the stakes are lower? Because one of my observations, certainly not on day one of working with people on positioning and specialization, but maybe after a year, year and a half, I started to say to myself, the thing that contributes to failure is a combination of high stakes, perceived high stakes even, and a low amount of information, a low supply of evidence. You bring those things together and people have and the failure that creates is indecision-making. I don't know if you have an easy time making decisions, and I promise this is at least tangentially related to confidence.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have an easy time making decisions or not, but I think anybody their decision-making is made more difficult when it's a high-stakes situation and they just don't have much to go on. Because then you're like, well, crap, the consequences are big and I don't have a basis for making an intelligent decision here. So I'm just going to have to guess, or I'm going to have to go with my gut or whatever. And some people are comfortable going with their gut, but not everybody. In fact, I would say the majority are not comfortable with that. So that got me thinking, how do we lower the stakes? How do we reverse those two conditions? Lower the stakes, increase the supply of information. And it seems like when you're practicing sales, that might also be helpful for cultivating confidence.
That's right. So I've been telling people when they ask me about Consulting Sales Bootcamp, one of the ways to not be so awkward talking about money is to start talking about it more in situations where your livelihood isn't on the line, partially. But also, let's reframe that. If you lose your next deal as a consultant, and that puts you out of business, the problem is much bigger than confidence, right? And like, that's almost certainly not the proposition anyway. It just feels that way.
Yeah.
You'll be able to make it to the next sales conversation that could lead to something. Yeah. But yes, I mean, exactly right. And I think there's a lot of things going on there. So in a low stakes situation, if I say to you, Philip, tell me how much you charge and then do it with a completely straight face, no emotion, completely matter of fact, and then say nothing. And I say, okay, go. So how much does it cost, Philip? And then you say it. Afterwards, I could say, okay, let's review. What do you think you did well? What can we improve upon? All right, let's do it again. right? And part of it is, you know, in sports and athletics, we talk a lot about muscle memory. And I really believe that just the repetition of doing this over and over again really contributes to that sort of problem-solving ability, the kind of on your feet, adapt and apply. And the reason is you're elevating your competence. You're no longer having to think, okay, what's in my toolbox here, right? You already know, okay, if I get asked the price question, here's what I'm going to do, right? And I'm no longer thinking about it as if it's has emotion attached. I have to press play on this script that I'm going to execute, right? Not to say you should be reading off of anything, just that the level of comfort increases dramatically, right? So even, let's look at it, let's say there are three evenly weighted dimensions, competence, problem solving, and intrinsic self-worth. So even if you're not increasing your self-worth, if we increase our problem solving and our competence, we know for sure we're going to be more confident.
Yeah.
For sure, right? And of course, there's going to be a positive feedback loop in each of those categories.
Yeah, it just occurred to me that there's this whole idea of a first impression, like you're going to make up your mind about somebody in, I don't know, there's some number of seconds that's bandied about usually.
I think it's three.
Okay, 3 seconds. And all those clues are going to come from someone's appearance, body language, how they move, stuff like that. And it occurs to me that I bet that happens again. If you're dealing with a buyer who's not pretty sophisticated, and many buyers are not, even if they think they are, they're not that truly sophisticated because there's so much risk in the types of projects that our audience is involved in, whether they're software projects or marketing projects or whatever. Yep. It's difficult to ascertain value precisely. And so that seems like a first impression situation. Liston names a price, and all of a sudden, there's about a 3-second window where he's giving off signals about whether the value of the project on the table corresponds with that price, or whether there's a mismatch between the value and the price. So I wonder if the buyer doesn't just sort of scrutinize you for 3 seconds that's their first set of inputs, maybe, even before they think about it. Do you have any evidence that it actually happens?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, of course it does, right? Everything we do, think, and say will affect the other person's impression of us.
Okay.
Outside, just like in any human interaction.
Right. So just in an ongoing basis.
We're calculating. We're always going like, okay, again, right? We have these models where we make assumptions and we're always trying to calculate and correct. Like, okay, how close is that? Right? What new am I learning from this person? Ooh, I'm not feeling that. So if when you say your price, this is a big one too. Yeah. It's a really big one. So if you say your price and someone goes, okay, how much is it to work with you, Philip? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what you charge, but let's say you say $5,000 a month. How's that sound?
Right.
Versus how much is it to work with you? It's $5,000. And just let that hang.
Yeah. I'm getting the benefit of a video layer here that the audience is not, but hopefully I think they probably heard that in your voice. It was pretty clear to me just in the audio.
Well, I'm not ending with upwards inflection. It's not a question. There's a level of confidence just in my tone of voice, in the way it's said, that will affect the way it's perceived. But I do want to focus not on the perception of the other person, but on the level of confidence that we have, because that's the topic here. So let's go to belief for a second, Philip, because you brought this up. So one of the readers of my newsletter, his name's Brooke, he challenged me on a point. So in the article, I make the argument that confidence comes from a belief that you will succeed, more or less, right? And there's like all these different components that make up that belief. And he says, I thought perhaps it didn't touch deep enough on the belief in your competence component. Like, how much of this belief should come from working on your competence, and how much should come from believing more?
Oh, that's so interesting.
And I think this is what you were getting at, right?
Right, yeah, because ultimately, I believe that beliefs are malleable.
They are.
And they can be based on, like, you can insist that there's a ton of evidence before you'll believe something. And some of us can happily believe all kinds of things with very little evidence. So it just all seems to point to the fact that belief is quite malleable. I'll stop there. I want to hear what you're about to say. I think Brooke brings up a super interesting point there.
He really does. And it's a great point, because I didn't want to leave anybody the impression that if you just believe, everything will work itself out, because now we sort of look at, okay, separate from confidence, what are the determinants of success? And competence is a huge one. And even though it's a factor of confidence, it's also a factor of like, well, how well are you going to do in your business? How much can you make the case that you're worth your price and that other people will continue to get the same benefits from you that the last people got? And so I use the example of this movie called The Disaster Artist. Are you familiar with that?
It's in my queue to watch. I haven't watched it yet. You and I discussed it a while back.
So here's a story of confidence run awry. So there's this guy named Tommy. He's a real person. He is objectively just an atrocious actor. He's awful, right? Anybody who views his acting would agree, like, this is exceptionally bad. Is he trying to be that bad? He bankrolled, wrote, and directed a movie called The Room, which in many circles is seen as the worst film ever made and released.
Worse even than Battlefield Earth. Okay.
Right.
That's pretty far down the list.
Yes. The Ode to Scientology.
Yeah.
So throughout the filming of the movie, first of all, the movie I think is really funny and really well done. Not The Room, but The Disaster Artist, the movie about the making of The Room and Tommy Wiseau. He seems to have no conception of what's happening or how bad this is. So it's not just belief in competence that's necessary. It's also actual competence and also self-awareness. Right? So in order to continue to calibrate your competence, you need to be able to say, well, that wasn't good enough. What can I do to improve? Right? Otherwise, if today you sit here and say, I'm the best in the world at this, what are you going to do? There's no reason to continue to improve your competence or improve your problem-solving skills. So your confidence will actually become a hindrance to yourself.
So now we arrive at my particular problem that I suffer from less now than I did 5-7 years ago. But I think some folks will see themselves reflected in this. So there's the question of, how do you assess your competence? What feedback mechanism do you use? How do you evaluate your competence? That's the first part of it. And the second part is, how does it correspond with business value? Because if you sort of lean in the perfectionist direction, you might assess your competence differently than your clients would, and you might undervalue your ability to create value compared to how your clients would. There's a variation of this, which is more of a perceptual thing, which is Jonathan Stark calls this selling to your own wallet, where you're like, well, I would never spend more than X amount on this thing, so that must be what it's worth. Is the maximum I would spend personally out of my own wallet. You talk to a manufacturing business that's making $10 million a year, and they're happy to spend 100 times that because it makes sense for them to do that. And the yield, the benefit they're going to get from that thing is 10 or 100 times what an individual would. So anyway, I know I'm bringing up a lot of stuff here, but the core question is, I think one of perception is, how do you get feedback that's not distorted maybe by your own personality, feedback about your level of competence?
Yeah. Well,
no, I'm always opening up in a can of worms.
It's a very difficult question. And especially the part about like, how does that correlate to business value and how do we make that determination? These are really hard questions.
And the reason I bring it up, if I may, is while you're looking that up, is it's important. And I think the people who figure this out, they start to have an edge that's not a small little edge. It's a big edge. Yep. When they're like, businesses will pay buckets of money for this thing that I would never value personally. You figure that out and that can really change your business. And that's why I think it's important.
Okay. So how do I get the feedback is the first question.
Sure.
I think there are various ways. I think one thing you can do is just look historically. Like, where do I tend to land in maybe competitive situations. So I do want to answer this with the story of a bank robber.
Oh, I was hoping you would.
Well, your wishes are granted, my friend. So there was this guy named MacArthur Wheeler. right? And he went around and he robbed banks without a mask. And the reason he did that is he was convinced that if he covered his face with lemon juice,
heard that,
it would render his face invisible by security cameras.
Yep.
So two social scientists, David Dunning and Justin Kruger, went, how could someone possibly be so fucking dumb? Basically, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, was this guy never recorded on with a camera in his life and he could see that, like, we could see his face?
That was in the abstract for their scientific paper about this. How can people be so fucking dumb?
Right. And so they started doing studies about trying to figure out, like, what was happening here.
Right.
Well, two things happened. The first, which was predictable based on MacArthur Wheeler's bank robbing career, is that students who scored low on tests, they tended to rank themselves too high among their classmates. So if you ask them, how do you think you're going to do on this? Or how do you think you did actually after they took the test? Mm-hmm. They go, oh man, I was great. I'd be in like the top 20 percentile.
Right.
Right. On the other hand though, this was the big surprise. And this is why I think the Dunning-Kruger effect is such a big deal. People who had higher scores tended to grossly underestimate their rank. And I think for a lot of consultants and experts, that's what's going on. That's one reason they're lacking confidence, is because they're so good. And by their nature, they're always thinking, I'm not the best. And so they're driven to improve themselves, improve that competence and problem solving piece.
And that's what got them there in the first place, right? To that level of goodness or greatness.
Exactly right. And so they're underestimating their ability. So I'll just relay this with a really concrete example. So I, early in my career in digital marketing, was listed on someone's website who connected people in a marketplace who were looking for digital marketers,
yeah,
right? With digital marketers.
Mm-hmm.
And she reached out to me and she said, hey, how are the leads that you're getting? And I said, they're amazing. It's like a business in a box. Like, I don't even know why you don't charge me way more.
Yeah.
And she goes, really? And I said, yeah. What? Why do you say it like that? And she said, well, I talked to all the other people who are getting leads also, and they say the leads are terrible. They're not able to close any business. Hmm. And I said, well, it could be because I'm closing most of it, or I'm the person who gets the people who are willing to make a decision.
Right.
But that was the first time I thought, huh, I must be pretty good at sales. Like, cause like that was a very clear example of me compared to other people. I think one thing you can do is go to peers and show them your work, right? And ask, like, what do you think of this? And get their thought process. So yeah, if you write code, you have such an advantage because there's such an open source kind of mentality about software and writing code. You can show that to other people and ask them, like, what do you think of this? What do you think of my work? And they give you feedback. Wouldn't they, Philip? I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, but...
Yeah, I think in general, yes. The thing that confounds that, which it applies to anything, it's like, you know, if you do marketing and you write white papers... Well, first of all, you can compare against other stuff that you could just easily download from the internet.
Exactly. So that's one way.
So it's quite out there in the open. But the thing is, there's always a context around code. And so sometimes really bad, technically bad code can produce tons of business value. And that's the sort of X factor. That's the other part of this question. I think for simplicity's sake, we should either have a whole nother podcast about that or just set it aside here, because again, it's like really crappy code can produce a ton of money in terms of value. And that complicates it, and that makes it not a simple one-dimension thing about how you define.
Do you have an example in mind on that note?
There's a couple examples out there. It's not bad code, but there are very, like Tumblr. How much is the Tumblr platform worth? How much did Yahoo pay for it?
Well, what is it worth and what Yahoo paid for it, I think, are two very different questions.
All right. You're right.
But yes, over $1 billion.
PHP. Super not sexy. Written largely or entirely in PHP. Not a sexy framework. Not a sexy language. It's something that a lot of software developers would look down their nose at and say, well, that language has got so many limitations. And really what they're saying is it's mature and anybody can learn it. And so it's not an exciting learning curve anymore.
Yeah.
So they kind of look down their nose at it and they project all this bullshit onto it that's not true. But that would be an example of how the complexity of the code doesn't map to the value of the thing that was built with it. But anyway, that's a bit of a rabbit hole. That sort of confounds our ability to measure our own competence. But also, the other thing I wanted to say is, I think it gets back to something you said earlier. Leaders read.
Yep.
Leaders are readers.
There you go. That has a better ring to it.
That's a way to measure or understand where you fit in terms of competence, is simply reading what other people like you are writing. And you can say anything in the written word, but if you do enough of that, you start to kind of get a feeling for the world you're in. And that's something that I didn't do much of at all earlier in my career. And I think it contributed to me sort of not knowing where I fit in the world. I was curious. I just didn't really know where to look to sort of see where people like me were sharing what they learned. So that's one way. I think it's just reading. And like you said, a lot of times you can sort of compare your work against what other similar people have done, because a lot of it is going to end up online somehow. Not all of it, of course, but if you're a CFO, I don't think you're going to compare your market share projection spreadsheets against somebody else's, because that would be proprietary info. But also, if you're a CFO, you're kind of at the top of the organization, and maybe your questions about competence have been put to bed by now.
Well, the bottom line, though, that I would say is on the competence and problem solving, I'm a huge proponent of reading, because someone else took their time to put all of their life's work in a digestible format for you to learn the lessons that they learned, right? So maybe it took them 30 years to figure out what occupies 300 pages of text. Not only do you get to soak up the knowledge that they had, but you get to hear some of the scenarios that they faced and what they chose to do and what they learned from those scenarios and those choices that they made. I mean, there's just a tremendous benefit. And no matter where you are on the competence meter in whatever you're doing, you could be better. And I do want to go over something really quickly, Philip. I want to go over some really bad advice on how to build your confidence, because I see this all over the place online. And so this was actually told to me in grad school, right? So in grad school, we had a career center and we had a little coaching for how to interview effectively, right? Because the grad school, they want everybody to get huge paying jobs so they can say, our class made X thousand dollars a year.
Yeah.
And so one of the pieces of advice was, if you have a phone interview, put on a suit and tie and stand up while you're doing your interview.
Mm.
While that may be interesting advice, that is so marginal compared to preparing for the interview, let's say, right? Like being able to ask good questions.
Yeah.
It's so marginal in comparison to the other things that you could do. So I'm looking at an article on HubSpot, HubSpot.com's blog.
That's my favorite source for bad advice.
Yeah. If you ever want to do inner work or self-improvement, you should head directly to HubSpot's blog. This is the place to get the information.
Cutting edge.
And they say 5 psychology-based exercises to boost your self-confidence. Number one, do a power pose.
What's a power pose?
Do
they have a little picture there?
I think you're lacking confidence. Otherwise, you would know what that is.
Shit. Okay. Sorry.
Hold on. It actually defines it. It says, here are the instructions. Here are 5 high power poses to try out the next time you need a boost. Number one, lean back in your chair with your feet up on a table, hands folded behind your head. This reminds me of like the boss in like the Flintstones or something, right?
Yeah.
The quintessential TV boss. Number two, stand up and lean over slightly with both hands resting on a table surface. It's very specific. Number three, stand with your legs apart and hands on your hips. Number four, lean back in your chair with one ankle crossed over your other knee, hands folded behind your head. We could go on.
Damn it, Liston, we have so overcomplicated this. Why didn't you start? Did you have this all along and you just didn't start with this? This is the advice we needed.
It all comes down to the PowerPoint.
We're totally overthinking this.
So I worked with this guy. I wanted to share this with you. I worked with this guy who I won't name, but at one point he goes, you know, Liston, you ask a lot of questions. And of course I answered with a question. I said, what's your point?
What makes you say that?
Right. Well, I said, what's your point? And he goes, well, you know, if you want to be seen as a leader at this company, you need to make statements, not questions. That's what leaders do. They make statements.
Oh, this was like some person above you on the ladder giving you what they thought was going to be really helpful advice.
He wasn't actually above me. I would say we were peers. We were like at the exact same sort of level of responsibility. Maybe politically, he had a little more clout than me, but on the org chart, I think we were pretty much peers. And I inside wanted to say, you're a fucking moron. That is the worst advice I've ever heard in my life. Like, the reason I ask questions is because I want to understand. How can you be a leader if you don't seek to understand? That's such ridiculous advice.
Yeah.
Anyway, but his advice was to appear confident, make statements, don't ask questions. So this is the kind of advice I want you to avoid. Here's some other highlights from the HubSpot article. Have a confidence buddy. Listen to a high power song. Maybe that's EDM for you, Philip. Take on an alter ego. So these are the kinds of things I want you to avoid. Certainly, if you have confidence, you will speak with certainty. Certainly, if you have confidence, there will be other behaviors that would sort of demonstrate your confidence. But I would say start working on yourself and shore up any evidence that you can create around, am I competent? Am I able? And then you'll start to see a big difference.
Yeah. Well, wow. I think that HubSpot article is our playbook for the rest of this podcast. You're now my confidence buddy, Liston.
Well, Philip, the listeners can't see this, but of course, you only record the podcast in the power pose.
Yes, I am continually in a power pose throughout this entire podcast. It's part of why it's so good.
You are in so much of a power pose that when you write emails, they're power pros. Oh, I'll be here.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Yes, sir. Well, have we done it?
That's terrible advice.
That is a terrible pun, but I had to.
That was pretty funny, though. Nice job on that. What have we missed? I mean, there is a certain amount to be said for practice. And like you, I think our beliefs are malleable. To me, I sort of touched on this earlier, the biggest problem spot is undervaluing what you actually are good at. So it's not being not good enough. I think that's less the problem, although that can be a problem. I think the more frequent problem is sort of undervaluing it, like not understanding how it contributes to business value for your clients. Mm-hmm. So I think that's maybe the first place to tackle. Part of what helps, oddly enough, is understanding how like the manufacturing process can convert like a few pennies worth of raw materials into a few hundred dollars worth of product at retail prices. That's maybe not a great analogy, but it's just so easy to overlook your own value. I guess that's where I kind of land at the end of this is, I think that was my confidence problem. It wasn't that I was or was not great at writing white papers, which was something I did 5-7 years ago. I was, I think, pretty good at it. It was good enough to do it for Microsoft, and they published over a dozen white papers that I authored. That's good enough from a competence perspective. I mean, that's middle of the pack. It's not world class. But that wasn't my problem in those sales conversations after I went solo. It was not understanding the value of what I did and not trusting myself to troubleshoot if things went wrong or just figure things out if I ran into something I didn't understand.
I think there's lots of ways to address this, but I do want to leave it here because maybe this merits another conversation. This is where I want to leave it. It is wherever you are now, there's room for improvement. There's room to increase your competence. It also helps to enter challenging situations and see what happens. And generally, you're going to handle those challenging situations a little bit better than you think. And if you can step them up in intensity over time, that's a kind of a safer way to build that muscle. So that's where I want to leave it today, Philip.
Thanks for being my confidence buddy, Liston.
I'll always be your confidence buddy. Text me later, okay?
Later. Bye.
Bye.